Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
Ukraine is finally about to get what it's been fighting for. Ukraine is finally about to get what nearly 10,000 people have died for. Ukraine is finally about to get what the Kremlin did everything in its power to prevent. After a popular revolution and more than 3 years of war, Ukraine is finally getting its association agreement and free trade pact with the European Union. They're getting it despite Vladimir Putin's attempts to bribe and blackmail former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych.
Це є надзвичайно важливі кроки на нашому шляху до об'єднаної Європи. І ми твердо налаштовані йти до нашої стратегічної мети. Це гарантія нашої свободи, незалежності та територіальної цілісності. Європа – це наш цивілізаційний вибір.
Russia Today et Sputnik ne se sont pas comportés comme des organes de presse et des journalistes, mais ils se sont comportés comme des organes d'influence, de propagande et de propagande mensongère, qui parfois, évidemment, est fait de désagréments, mais qui est exigeant de part et d'autre. Nous n'arriverons à aucune avancée, ni sur le sujet ukrainien, ni sur le sujet syrien, pour ne citer que ces deux-là.
It was the final pen stroke at the end of a brazen land grab. Russian President Vladimir Putin signing the order to annex Crimea 3 years ago.
Оці великі зміни, яких бажаємо, бо вони направду потрібні для нашої держави, для нашого народу, мусимо випрацювати, вибороти самі.
Violence continues unabated in eastern Ukraine. Last week we actually recorded a 45% increase in the number of ceasefire violations.
The EU-Ukraine Association Agreement was ratified by the Netherlands on Tuesday, the 30th of May. It was the last EU country to ratify the agreement signed back in 2014. Just after the Dutch vote, EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said, quote, "Today's vote in the Dutch Senate sends an important signal from the Netherlands and the entire European Union to our Ukrainian friends. Ukraine's place is in Europe." Unquote. Ukraine's President Poroshenko said, quote, "This is the guarantee of our freedom, independence and territorial integrity. Europe is our civilizational choice." Unquote. Ukraine Calling listeners will probably remember that this agreement was signed after the Revolution of Dignity. Most EU states ratified the document, including the Dutch Parliament back in 2015. But a group of Dutch citizens called for a referendum on the issue, and the treaty was rejected by a slim majority of the 32.2% of the population which voted. But the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, found a compromise and got the Senate to vote in favor of the agreement. So, after this delay, a major victory for Ukraine and a significant loss for Putin. Late in the show, we'll bring you a feature interview with British, Kyiv-based journalist and commentator Peter Dickinson on Ukraine in light of recent international affairs. Well, Ukraine's association with the EU is, of course, not just about benefits like visa-free travel, but also responsibilities and commitments. A top EU official reminded Ukraine of this while visiting Kyiv. On the 1st of June, EU Enlargement Commissioner Johannes Hahn criticized a recent law targeting non-governmental organizations investigating state corruption and urged greater independence for the agency charged with exposing graft, NABU. quote, "The EU is happy to provide assistance, but we also expect Ukraine to deliver results," unquote, he added. There was more good news this week for Ukraine. Ukraine won a major case in the Arbitration Institute of the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce. The tribunal ruled against Russia and in Ukraine's favor. The Russian state-owned energy company Gazprom moved for arbitration back in June 2014. It was about the 2009 Russia-Ukraine gas agreement signed by then Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, which included a take-or-pay clause. Gazprom was arguing that Naftogaz Ukraine had agreed to purchase a certain amount of gas every year and therefore was required to pay for that amount whether they actually purchased it or not, and that Ukraine owed them $45.7 billion, which is about half of the country's GDP. Ukraine's gas company Naftogaz rejected the claim and filed a counterclaim. Under the leadership of a new CEO, Andriy Kobolyov, named as one of Forbes' top 40 under 40, the Ukrainian energy company alleged that Russia was overcharging Ukraine. After years of back and forth, the dispute was finally settled in Ukraine's favor. The tribunal decided that Naftogaz Ukraine was entitled to a market-reflective adjustment of the price formula. Ukraine's President Poroshenko said that Moscow had lost its opportunity to use gas as an instrument of political pressure and blackmail. Ukraine figured during Russian President Putin's trip to Paris this week. The new French president, Emmanuel Macron, accused Russian state media of spreading fake news and propaganda against him during the May presidential election. He did this while standing next to Putin in a joint press conference at Versailles. Macron also said, quote, "If we don't have a frank and sincere dialogue, which at times obviously leads to disagreements, we will not advance on the subject of Ukraine nor the subject of Syria," unquote. The new French president supports the continuation of sanctions against Russia. Another tempest erupted when Putin called Anna Yaroslavna, Russian Anne. This 11th-century princess was born in Kyiv, then capital of the Kievan Rus principality. Her father, Prince Yaroslav, married her to the King of France, Henry I. She became Queen Consort of France and later regent during the minority of her son, Philip I of France. CNN and other media outlets reported that Putin's remark was seen as an attempt to blur the lines between Ukrainian and Russian history, and the Twitter storm followed. We'll post a link to some of the reactions on our website. Meanwhile, the war in the East against Russian aggression continues. The OSCE reported a 45% increase in heavy shelling in Ukraine's war zone this past week. In Krasnohorivka alone, 29 buildings were destroyed, among them a hospital and a school. 9 civilians were injured, 6 women and 3 men. 1 Ukrainian soldier was killed and 32 wounded. And in Kyiv on the 1st of June, there was an attempt to assassinate another foe of the Putin regime. The victim was a Russian citizen, Adam Osmayev, who had earlier been accused in Russia of plotting an assassination attempt against the Russian president, and who has been leading a Chechen volunteer group fighting on the Ukrainian side in the Donbas. The would-be killer is reported to have posed as a French journalist and managed to fire at and wound Osmayev before being shot and seriously wounded by Osmayev's wife. And in Lviv, on a sad note, Ukraine lost a spiritual leader this week. Cardinal Lubomir Husar died on the 31st of May at the age of 84. He had served as the head of the Ukrainian Catholic Church from 2000 until 2011, when he stepped down to make room for a younger leader. He remained active both in the church and civic life, and was a founding member of the 1st of December group of leading intellectuals that formed during the 2013-2014 Euromaidan protests. On the 1st of December 2013, Cardinal Husar took to the stage to address the crowd despite freezing temperatures. He said, quote, "If you want to live in a normal country and pass it on to your children and grandchildren, we must do good. Якщо хочете жити у нормальній державі, передати її дітям і внукам, чинімо добро." Among Cardinal Husar's achievements was moving the seat of the Ukrainian Catholic Church to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Well, welcome to our focus in depth to this week, and I'm speaking with Peter Dickinson. Peter Dickinson is a well-known figure here on the Kyiv scene. He's been around a long time, but not only in Kyiv. He's one of these people, a Brit like myself, born, educated in the UK, who came to Ukraine, and I'll ask him why exactly he stayed. But he's done his bit to not only get established, but to contribute. He's the producer of Lviv Today, for example. He's also the chief editor or producer, he'll explain, of Business Ukraine, a very influential and quality business publication. But most recently, he's shot to new fame because he's been writing a series of articles, particularly for the Atlantic Council, in which he's offered his opinions and thoughts on where Ukraine is at, what issues it needs to face up to. And he's won an award for that. I'll ask him to explain all about that in a second. And he's become one of the leading journalists and writers that people take note of and listen to, not only within Ukraine, but outside of it. So I'm very happy to welcome today to our Ukraine Calling a fellow Brit, Peter Dickinson. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for that very, very generous introduction.
Well, let's begin by asking you to give a short little description of yourself. You're a Brit, but how did you end up in Ukraine?
Well, My journey to Ukraine began at the end of my university career, where I'm a graduate of Liverpool University, and towards the end of my final graduation year, I'd applied to the British Foreign Office, and one of the projects which I was considered for was a one-year project in Ukraine, which at the time was a very, very much an unknown quantity to me.
What were you studying in the UK?
History. History.
Like myself, history and politics.
Yeah, the fascinating, useless degree.
What do you mean useless?
Yeah, well,
we're here, aren't we? And we're talking.
Certainly, yeah. No, I mean, it does work out sometimes. So the Ukraine for me was very much a lottery, as it were. It wasn't something that I had initially chosen, but the position itself looked quite exciting. It was an opportunity, I thought, to perhaps develop some diplomatic experience. It was a embassy-managed project with the British Council. And I spent that year, this was in 1997-98, based in Lviv, which was at the time, you know, absolutely different to the Lviv of today, the tourist Lviv that we know now. It was a very isolated, very limited, and largely, I would say, still very Soviet city, even.
Provincial?
Extremely so. You know, now Lviv has you know, the feel of Lviv now is that it is the closest city to Europe the EU to Ukraine. I mean, I would say it's one of the most European cities in the continent.
You were in Lviv, but obviously you travelled to Kyiv, I presume.
Yeah, I travelled a lot, and the job involved travelling. I mean, I was the representative for West Ukraine for the British Council, so I travelled extensively throughout the region, and it was a wonderful opportunity in that sense that I was able to really get a flavour for different parts of the country and also interact with different, you know, business community, the diplomatic community, the government community.
So can we jump the gun a bit and say, what was the Ukraine that you discovered then? Was it a surprise? Was it something that you expected, something you'd read about? Or was it something new?
I mean, I think, first of all, I should hold my hands up and say I came with very little prior knowledge. And that's, you know, speaking as someone who'd studied a lot of European history, I knew very little about this part of the world at all, and Ukraine in particular. So I didn't have a very developed set of preconceived ideas about what I would be confronted by. But certainly, what I did expect was a lot bleaker, shall we say, than what I met. And I was fascinated by the wealth of culture here, by the cosmopolitan intelligence. I mean, it didn't surprise me that people were smart, but the fact that they were a lot more, in many ways, more European than I am.
To ask you, so you sense that there was a Europeanness about them?
Yes, and even in those days when the Soviet era was still, the shadow was still very long, even then, it amazed me and fascinated me that they were, you know, the people I interacted with, my friends, my colleagues, people I met, would have a much broader knowledge of European culture, and not only in a classical sense, but also in a contemporary sense, in terms of, you know, film directors, literature, arts, etc., than I had. And it made me, you know, it brought home to me how narrow the English cultural world is, actually.
But at that time, what, you knew Russian, or how did you communicate to the people?
Well, that was actually an interesting aside, that when I arrived, I had no language skills, but I set out to try and at least, you know, learn the basics. And but being based in Lviv, of course, you would assume that I would learn Ukrainian. But actually, at the time, I mean, my knowledge was so limited that I didn't really make that distinction. And my colleagues simply said, which would you prefer to learn? And I chose Russian because of its international reach, not expecting to stay here for the long term. So I actually began studying Russian and speaking Russian from the, I mean, it took a while, but, it, you know, after about half a year, I was conversant to an extent.
And at what stage did you feel that it was also important to know some Ukrainian?
I think it's definitely one of the things that I regret now, that I haven't developed my Ukrainian more. And I think it's getting to the point where it is becoming not difficult professionally, but socially awkward. I feel that I should speak better Ukrainian. But to be frank, I've never had an issue with it in Kiev, and even in Lviv, where obviously Ukrainian is by far the more widely spoken of the two languages. I've also always found that you can get by. Perhaps there's more leeway given to foreigners because there's recognised that they're from outside of the cultural milieu. But
so are you suggesting it's a tolerant society in that sense? Despite the image that is projected of Ukraine as, by some, as intolerant, neo-fascistic, ethnocentric, etc.
I've always found it to be largely tolerant. I think there are areas where there are areas of Ukrainian society that can appear shocking to Western audiences, often in the sense that there is there's a sort of tone-deaf approach to politically correct issues where things can be said that are shocking. But in a broader sense, yeah, I find that there's enormous tolerance in frankly, sometimes too much tolerance.
Okay, so let's jump ahead. This was the late 90s, right?
Yeah.
How would you compare the Ukraine of today with that period? What has changed? I mean, let's not go into great detail. We don't have time. But fundamentally, what do you think are the areas that change can be noted in?
Well, I think the biggest change is in terms of national identity, without a shadow of a doubt, I would say. I mean, I was in Lviv for that first year, and then I came to Kiev. We had a slight extension of the specific project I was doing, so we had a few months in Kiev, and that was when I decided to stay on, because at the time Lviv was extremely provincial, whereas Kiev was already, I mean, it is a huge, huge city, and I sensed that there could be exciting times here. But when I came to Kiev, the package...
Kiev, as we call it.
Yes, quite. The patriotism that I'd encountered in Lviv always seemed quite mild to me. And when I came here, I recognized, you know, the people here, it was unusual to meet someone who actually was engaged in Ukrainian ideas. And there was a huge indifference towards ideas of national identity, patriotism. And I found that quite surprising. And they had ideas when they heard I'd been in Lviv. They were like, oh, wow,
Even before the Orange Revolution.
Oh, yeah, this is around the turn of the millennium. And I think that the Orange Revolution was a real watershed in that sense, where a lot of people, there was an awakening of ideas of Ukrainian national identity. And it planted a seed, not only here, but across the country. And I think then Euromaidan, 10 years on.
But we had the disappointment, disillusionment, lost time in between.
Certainly, but even so, I think you had people coming through who, you know, expectations were there in the long term. They were saying, you know, I mean, in a way, you have to lower your expectations about how far things could move. I would say that, you know, remember how it was then at the turn of the millennium. There was really very little sense in my mind, in my experience. You know, I would routinely encounter people who were indifferent, and I was not. And I was engaged already then, and I was excited about this, you know, this country emerging on the European map, as it were, after so long, being being in the shadows or under foreign rule, and they weren't, and this has changed over time.
So you were here all that time, and what impact did the Maidan, the Euromaidan, and the Revolution of Dignity have on you personally, not on the country? Did it affect your views of the country, your expectations?
I think if we talk about the Orange Revolution, it was a shock for me. I can remember very specifically being on Maidan and just being amazed that there were so many people who had these feelings, clearly, who were motivated to come out. And although it's now seen as a, you know, compared to the horrors of the past 3 years and the tragedy, the death toll, you know, the Orange Revolution is now seen as quite a soft, basically, you know, sort of extended rock concert. at the time, that was, no one knew that. At the time, we, you know, there was widespread expectation that it would also be violent and it could also be very brutal. But they were there, and you know, the huge numbers. And I think it was a shocking experience for me in a very good sense, that this lack of engagement actually was not necessarily the true feelings of a lot of people. It was a defensive mechanism, perhaps, or something that they themselves had not really recognized until all of a sudden this moment arrived, and there they went. So that was, for me personally, a real eye opening and beautiful
reaffirmation of of something you suspected.
It was beautiful, really. I mean, I can honestly say it was one of those. It was, you know, it sounds a bit coy to say so, but it was genuine. It was genuinely yeah. beautiful. It was very emotional.
I mean, Yeats wrote about Ireland, "A terrible beauty is born," which I think is very applicable to Ukraine in many ways. You know, this terrible beauty that is always with us here. Anyway, but jumping ahead, as the question was, so the impact of Euromaidan and the revolution of dignity on you, where did that take you to in your understanding of what this country is about?
Yeah, I think that the events of 2000. Well, I would bracket together 2014 as an epiphany period. The Euromaidan itself, and then the Russian invasion, and particularly the whole this volunteer wave that kind of swept across the nation and saved Ukraine, in my opinion. I mean, this for me was it was taking things a step further. It was saying, okay. People had to make what the Russians achieved by using going for the military option rather than these continuous soft power attacks, which have been going on ever since I've been here. Frankly, it's not a new thing. They've always been chipping away at Ukrainian sovereignty and seeking to have an influence to contain Ukrainian notions of independence. But by launching a direct military attack, hybrid military attack. They forced Ukrainians to actually get off the fence. And a lot of people who had been indifferent or been ambiguous or never really addressed the issue of what they really felt about it had to make a choice. And the vast majority made that choice and said, oh, you know what, actually, I am Ukrainian.
Okay, and at this stage, obviously, there's a lot of sympathy and support in the outside world. But you and your friends in Britain, I presume you're still in touch with them regularly. How were they responding? Were they interested? Did they care? Did they understand?
Frankly speaking, I find it quite difficult to converse about Ukraine or to engage with people outside of Ukraine about Ukraine because it sounds so fantastical. You know, the idea that this is the largest nation in Europe, which a lot of them only know that they're aware of the fact that I live there. And they have no direct involvement or interest. It sounds, you know, I sometimes listen to myself talking about it with people, and I sound a bit like a fantasist or something, because it these things are very hard to grasp. From the outside, they sound literally incredible.
And how did we get to the publication of Lviv Today?
That was kind of a completing the circle for me. I as I said, I lived in Lviv when I first came here. Then I came to Kyiv, and I was engaged in. I stayed on in Kyiv and became engaged in the publishing world, and I always maintained my links with Lviv. And as I went back there over the years to see friends and to spend time there, which I would do regularly, the city began around the time of the Orange Revolution. I think it really took off, or just afterwards, really to noticeably, you know, regenerate, to have enter a sort of renaissance almost. And I got to the point where I felt, you know, this city, what it really needs now is some sort of an English language publication. Now, I had managed to acquire the experience here of running that sort of publication, so it seemed like a logical thing to get.
And congratulations, friends. You've just published your 100th issue.
Yes, 100 issues, yeah. And I mean, I that's one. I have two publications as well in Kyiv, Business Ukraine here as well. Lviv Today is amazing in the sense that it just keeps going on regardless of crises, revolutions, wars. It's a really steady publication, and the people of Lviv have responded extremely positively to it, I think, because they feel that it is something that the city needs.
And Business Ukraine, tell us a little bit about that, your other publication here in Kyiv.
Yeah, Business Ukraine is also a monthly distributed here in Kyiv. That's more a current affairs publication. My publishing background, I was actually one of the founders of What's On magazine, which is currently out of print. Hopefully we'll come back, but at the moment not in print. But that ran for about 14, 15 years. That was set up in 1999, so I went there after my time with the embassy. And I ran that for around 7 years and then was invited to join a new project, which is Business Ukraine, in around 2000. It was 2007. It was set up by an American publishing group connected to the News Corp group. When the crisis of 2008 arrived, they exited the market. So I was in a position as chief editor to take on the title. So at that point, I took the plunge and set up my own publishing house.
Well, obviously, it's they're very needed products here. Let's move on. In the meantime, more recently, you've become a very prominent figure in the journalistic publicistic world as far as writing about Ukraine is concerned. And it's partly because of this linkage I see with the Atlantic Council, yeah? How did you get involved with them?
I began writing for the Atlantic Council in the spring of last year. I think that there was through a few mutual contacts, and that they've always been active in this part of the world, and that they are very much engaged in the post-Soviet sphere. But I think that with the Ukraine crisis continuing, there was a need to get more voices, and frankly there are not a lot of English language voices coming out of Kyiv, so I was very happy to engage with them.
And can you tell listeners who may not be aware, what did you win the award for?
Well, it was an article I got the award for the I think it was for their Ukraine Alert Service article of the year, for an article which was quite critical of the Western media coverage of the conflict in Ukraine, in particular looking at the terminology that's been employed throughout the period, and the ambiguity and the failure to identify Russia as a party to the conflict and as the aggressor, which essentially is playing into the hands of the Kremlin's hybrid war strategy. Ambiguity is a core component part of that. So I addressed that quite forcefully, and there was a very positive reaction from Ukraine. Not so positive from some of the correspondents, who felt that they were being unduly criticised. But I think that overall, it was something that a lot of people had been, good opinion pieces usually is the sort of thing you read and say, yeah, I was thinking that. And I think a lot of people had that on their mind for a long time. Like, these guys are letting us down. And the issue, the fact that a lot of them, in fact, the vast majority of them are based in Moscow, also raised significant question marks over their ability to objectively and accurately report on a war which Russia is participating in.
And I look at your most recent publications, Eurovision, Victory for Ukraine, Fighting the Kremlin's Fake News, How to Boost the International Image of Ukraine, Five Things That Impressed Me About Ukraine. All good stuff, and we'd like our listeners to look at these, and these can be found on which site?
The publication. I mean, I generally, apart from my own titles, I generally publish with the Atlantic Council. But one of the benefits of the Atlantic Council is I found that they have an extremely, extremely good reach, and a lot of their materials are picked up elsewhere, also in the Ukrainian and Russian languages, which has been a very rewarding experience for me to see my articles in the Ukrainian and also in the Russian media, which has been quite interesting. Right.
But let's just spend the last few minutes on the most recent one that has attracted a lot of attention, in which you suggest that the Ukrainians are their own worst enemy, and that their constant criticism of their conditions, of their situation, their unhappiness, sort of getting at one another constantly, that this is much more of a threat than even Putin himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something I've always been aware of since I first came, this, the glass half empty mentality, the idea that if you talk with a few Ukrainian friends about something, one of them will tell you the situation is bad and the other one will say, no, it's much worse. And this kind of, the opposite of one-upmanship almost. And this is, I always associated it with, the sense of a genuinely, deeply traumatic, in many respects, tragic history. And of course, if you've no one wants to be the sucker. They say, okay, if we're always getting the short end of the stick, the cynicism is a kind of defense mechanism in that respect, which is totally understandable. But it is, as I said in the article, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you constantly talk things down, you will find that things don't work out. You will find that people don't have faith in you. And you will find, especially, I think, from a point of view of the country's current situation, that investors will say, hold on. I just talked to some guy who told me some terrible horror stories. I don't think we should, now's not the time to invest, even though it looks good on paper. And so it's, I think from a foreigner's point of view, I'm not alone in this, I'm sure. I mean, there's, the talk to the expats here. I mean, it's a very engaging country, and we're all, the vast majority, very enthusiastic, very engaged.
Eurovision. A success for Ukraine, you say?
A huge success, I would say. I mean, it's not the World Cup or the Olympics. I mean, it doesn't get that much exposure and it doesn't bring that many people, but it does, there were hundreds of journalists here. I was monitoring the British press closely and I was seeing in the peripheral vision, other publications, but certainly in Britain, there were, a wide range of materials about, not about Eurovision per se, about Kyiv, about Ukraine. And they were overwhelmingly positive. This has always been another one of my favorite themes, that if you want, if you see Ukraine, if you bring people to see Ukraine, they will come with low expectations and they will leave pleasantly surprised. And this is what we saw, and this is one of the ways to boost the image of the country.
Okay, Peter, well, to finish and to maintain this positive note, you recently published a piece entitled Five Things That Impressed Me About Ukraine. Can you remember offhand what they were? just in bullet point.
Let me think. I probably can, actually. Yeah. Well, I remember the last one, which was a kind of slightly less serious one, was that the trains always impressed me, that the trains are always on time, which as an Englishman is extremely impressive. Literally to the minute. You don't even think about it. You know it's going to be on the minute. They're not fast. But they are insanely punctual, which is impressive. What else? The volunteerism would have certainly been on the list. That amazed me. I think it's partly a byproduct of a dysfunctional government, frankly, and that's a reality. But again, you can sit and do nothing, or you can take the action. And most of the good things I see have got a significant element of that volunteerism in it. Even the reforms in government.
Are you encouraged by the younger generation here?
Hugely. I think the huge threat now is that people. I mean, the brain drain is a constant factor here, and it's got worse in the last few years because of the situation in the country. It's not a matter of life and death for Ukraine, but it is a major issue for the country's future, and they've got to keep this young. They've got to keep young people. And not only what we have here in the capital, this is a huge and very European city, but if you go to the regional capitals, they have to make life attractive for young people there.
Yeah, okay. And last but not least, any topics that you intend to write on soon, or projects that you want to work on? What are you particularly interested in at the moment?
Tourism. Tourism is something I'd like to explore a little bit more. Particularly people who are doing interesting things in the tourism sector. I think Ukraine has huge potential there. We've got the EU visa-free regime now in place, which of course is about Ukrainians traveling to Europe and exploring the EU. But of course, as people interact, that will build bridges and relationships. And I think there's huge scope for Ukraine there. And it's not just Kyiv, Lviv, Odessa. It's Kamenets-Podilsky, it's the Dnipro, it's the Carpathians. There's a whole range of places that can develop there. There's health tourism, etc. So that would be a really interesting area to develop. And again, it would boost the country's image. Again, bring people here.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, Peter, that was, I think we covered a lot of ground. I just want to remind our listeners, we've been talking to Peter Dickinson, who is a veteran Ukraine watcher, publisher, analyst, journalist, etc., etc., but who has really come into his own, particularly in recent months with his percipient analytical pieces, sort of reaching the parts that other journalists and commentators don't. I think Brits will understand what I'm getting at. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Cheers. And now, moving on to culture. Well, in Kyiv, has been a very interesting exhibition opened of works by Arsen Savadov. It's showing at the Art Ukraine Gallery. And it depicts situations that could exist only in a dream. A still life shows bottles of Chanel perfumes ready to serve as Molotov cocktails, perched on the rubble of Maidan. In another painting, there's a morose harlequin with a violin seated under a grove of birch trees with showers of lozenges drifting down like leaves. Yet another work is an orange volcano exploding on the canvas with bluebirds and cherubs and grasshoppers being scattered in all directions. These are some of the surreal images that remain with you after viewing Arsen Savadov's latest solo exhibition of paintings, leaving you with the disturbing, uneasy feeling that you have just woken from a dream. One of the first paintings is, in fact, titled Gulliver's Dream and lends its name to the whole exhibition, a sleeping giant tied down to the ground with little strings and pencils. A metaphor to comment on Ukraine or on the role of art and music? Arsen Savadov is recognized as an important Ukrainian contemporary artist who attracted critical attention already in the late 1980s, a part of the trans-avant-garde movement. In his earlier projects, he also worked more with photography and often succeeded in provoking and shocking audiences. For example, his well-known photography series from 20 years ago was titled Donbass Chocolate. And now the latest solo exhibition draws on many aspects of classical painting and includes allusions to Bruegel, Dali, to music and to well-known symbols in literature, an exploration of the role of art and beauty in life. Savadov commented on his exhibition saying, quote, "We are all disappearing, and the traces of our emotions remain in these images imprinted on the canvases. Only the emotions and the captured dreams remain," end quote. And now for music. Well, there's a new band in Kyiv. They're called Vasyan Bapaznyak, a name that's made up of fragments of the band members' names. And they call themselves a project rather than a band. In case you haven't had a chance to hear them, here's their song called Planet Love. Enjoy.
Планета любов, кілометри доріг, мало у ліжку на дворі. Любов стріла, у кожного своя, спомин серця тонка павутина. Любов жара, одночасно вода, краплями срібла дощі. Любов в словах, мелодія сумна, в лабіринті твоя половина, половина. Любов сягає вище неба, любов не випити до дна. Любов сягає вище неба, іноді комета, іноді зоря. Планета любов наївна без меж, змішує фарби дощі. Феміда любов зіграла цю роль, певно чаша довіра єдина, єдина. Любов сягає вище неба, любов не випити до дна. Любов сягає вище неба, іноді комета, іноді зоря. Зайві маршрути забуті, павутина узорами білими, чорними.
деколи болить душа. Людина хоче людину, любов жива. Любов сягає вище неба, любов не випити до дна. Любов сягає вище неба, іноді комета, іноді зоря. Неба, іноді комета, іноді зоря.
I'm looking forward. Next week, Oksana Smerechuk will bring you a new feature interview. And we'll be following the headlines for you as always. Tune in again next Friday for a new episode. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.